Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this remote virtual hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. So this is our first hearing back in regular session. We've had some interim hearings. The procedure's been a little bit different, so we're going to be kind of back to regular order here. I'd like to remind members to please keep your mutes, keep your feeds muted, and use the raise hand function if you would like to be called upon. And the staff will be keeping a list for us to call on folks, hopefully in the order in which you have raised your hand. And because we're back in the regular session, we do need to take the roll. So Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Present.
Vice Chair Hewitt. Leach Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Representative Ackland.
Ackland present.
Representative Backer.
Backer present.
Representative Bonner.
Bonner present.
Representative Bierman. He said he'd be a couple minutes late. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Damoth.
Present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Kiel.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Munson.
Munson present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Ryer.
Present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
And Representative Wolgemut.
Present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. So the next order of business is to approve the minutes of May 1st, 2021, which was our last regular meeting. Representative Bolden.
I would like to move those minutes, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much. So members, these are the minutes. This was a meeting during which we passed House File 600, which is the cannabis legalization bill. I just am noting that so that if you want to check and make sure that your vote was correctly recorded, now would be the time to do that. And those were mailed out before this hearing. So all in favor of approval of minutes, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? The motion no. prevails? Okay, I didn't catch that. Who was no?
Grunhagen was no. I'm not voting for minutes with legalization of marijuana on it.
Okay, so we've got one no. Okay, that will be recorded, Representative Grunhagen. So the minutes are approved. Okay, so we have a full agenda today. We have three very distinguished presenters who are going to give us an update on what's going on with the pandemic here in Minnesota. And we're going to start with Assistant Commissioner Dan Huff from the Department of Health. And then we'll go to Dr. Osterholm. And then we have Dr. Greg Vanishkachorn from Mayo Clinic to and each of them will cover a slightly different aspect of what's going on. I think what we could do is, I think we could ask a few questions at the end of each of these three presentations rather than waiting for the complete end to ask any of them. If we kind of keep our questions concise so that we can move through them, but we'll see how that goes. So let's hold our questions through each of the presentations, and then we'll see if members have questions in between. And I've been reminded also, before we do go to that, that we do have a new fiscal analyst in this committee. And Joe Harney is here, and I wonder, Joe, if you would like to just introduce yourself before we get started with the presentation.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. My name is Joe Harney. I'm one of the new fiscal analysts covering Health and Human Services. I come to the House of Representatives from the Legislative Budget Office, where I was an analyst there for the past 3 years.
All right. Thank you so much. Okay. So with that, I think we will move to Mr. Huff. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, committee members. As Chair Liebling said, my name is Dan Huff, and I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Health. Next slide, please. I did just want to acknowledge that today is Groundhog Day, and happy Groundhog Day. Sometimes it with COVID, it kind of feels like Groundhog Day, the movie. I believe I was here a year ago talking with you about COVID, and unfortunately, I'm still talking about COVID. I wish that were not the case.
So, but, Mr. Huff, can groundhogs catch COVID?
You know, that is a great question, and I don't know the answer. Okay. B of M has done some research, actually, on some different animals, and as you've heard, white-tailed deer can catch COVID. We know that weasel or minks can, and we know that hamsters can, but I do not know about groundhogs.
All right. Sorry to pull you off track.
That's quite all right. Now I'm going to go look at look for any literature on that after this meeting. Next slide, please. So just a quick agenda of what I wanted to go over. I'm going to start with some virus basics because I think that just kind of helps ground us in how this infection works. We know a lot about COVID, and I know that you all read a lot and hear a lot from your constituents. So I just wanted to ground us in some of the basic biology. And then I'll go on to give some more updates about what's happening in Minnesota. Next slide, please. So this big sort of purplish blob thing is a cell. And that little round thing with the spikes on it is a virus. What viruses do is they cannot reproduce on their own. They are basically a little membrane that surrounds some genetic material, either RNA or DNA in this case for the virus that causes COVID, SARS-CoV-2, it's an RNA virus. So what it does is it attaches to human cells that have what's called an ACE2 receptor, and it has a spike protein that fits into that receptor, a lot like a key would fit into a lock, and it's able to gain entry into our cells where it takes over some of our apparatus and actually makes the cell begin to produce virus. It turns our own cells into a virus factory, and then they begin to release that virus out, and it kills the cell. They also, in these cells, they prevent the function of the ACE2 receptor, which is important for the health and maintenance of those cells. Now, these cells are found in, or the ACE2 receptors are found in epithelial and endothelial tissues, which line our lungs, they line our digestive tract, and they line our blood vessels, and even our heart. And that's why it's mostly a respiratory disease because it comes in and it gets into our lungs, but it also can get in our digestive system. That's why diarrhea is one of the symptoms of COVID. But then it can get into our blood vessels, and that's why you've heard where you have myocarditis or even strokes and heart attacks can occur, or kidney damage because there's a lot of blood vessels and kidneys. That's how COVID attacks the body. Next slide. And if we look at this sort of stylized artist rendering of COVID, you have all these spike proteins on it, and you've got the genetic material, the RNA on the inside. And you see that Y on the outside? That's a human antibody that is attempting to kind of bind up and neutralize that virus. When we test, we have three different tests that we use in testing for COVID. Or the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the first is called a molecular test. That's a PCR. That actually tests for the genetic material. That's considered the gold standard of testing because if there's a little bit of viral RNA, that PCR is going to pick it up. The antigen tests, so these are like Binax Now or the ones that you might pick up at CVS or Walgreens or Thrifty White, these are antigen tests. They're actually testing for that surface antigen, those spikes on the protein or on the virus. And we also have what's called serologic or antibody testing. And that's where you measure how much antibody is in your blood serum that would protect you. And that gives you an idea if you've been infected before and whether you might have immunity for it. Next slide. this gives you an idea of there's a cycle of infection. When you're first exposed to the virus, you have what's called an incubation period. And this is the period of time that it takes for, once the virus enters you, to really replicate enough to take over enough cells and to begin to produce more virus, that you start spewing virus and become infectious. That is, you can pass that on to someone else. And the tricky thing about COVID is you can actually be spewing the virus but not even know it, because you're pre-symptomatic or you just have no symptoms at all. And then after a period of time, your body, hopefully, unless you, you know, do not recover from COVID infection, your body begins to get the upper hand. It vanquishes the infection, your symptoms decline, and then your infectiousness, you stop spewing virus. If we look at when tests are accurate, antigen tests, those tests you can pick up at Walgreens, those will pick up the virus when you are symptomatic, because there's enough virus in there that they can pick up the antigens. So the problem with antigen tests is you might be infected, but you're not infected enough for the antigen to pick it up. The good thing about it is once you're no longer infectious on the other end of your infection, it probably is not going to detect it either. PCR, being much more sensitive, looking for that RNA, will pick up the viral particles even before you're infectious, but also after your infectious period. Next slide. All viruses mutate, and as an mRNA virus, SARS-CoV-2 mutates a lot more than, say, a DNA virus. Influenza is also an mRNA virus, and that's why we have so many different strains of influenza. Every year, we get a new mutation or a new variant of influenza, and that's because it's a mRNA virus. All, as I said, they all mutate, and some of the mutations just don't go anywhere, but some of them actually make a difference in how that virus can invade other cells or replicate and take over, and that's when we get a new variant coming around the world like we see. One of the challenges for right now with COVID, so many people are infected. There are so many places for I like to think of an infected person as a laboratory for mutation. Every infected person is having the virus inside of themselves, and that virus is mutating. You give it enough opportunities, it can mutate into something that becomes a more dangerous variant. And that's what we're seeing around the world with these variants. Next slide. So the what happens is usually you have the spike protein. You have a change there. And maybe it binds onto the cell more quickly. Maybe it causes the variant or the mutation makes it replicate or reproduce a lot faster. So what can happen is with variants of concern, you have mutations that cause the virus to be more transmissible, easier to catch. It makes it more severe disease. Maybe it makes it harder to test for and harder to find in a test. Maybe it makes our therapeutics, like our monoclonal antibodies or some of our antivirals that are being created, less effective, or maybe it helps evade a vaccine. So all of these things are concerning when we have all these folks in the world infected, where you have the virus always mutating, and then you can have variants spontaneously arise. Next slide. So the most common, or the most, I guess, the ones we've dealt with the most recently are Delta and then Omicron. Delta really took over Minnesota in September of last year, but it was quickly replaced by Omicron. By January or by last month, middle of last month, it was definitely the dominant strain in Minnesota. And it both of these, because they were highly infectious, spread throughout the state. Next slide, please. I find this chart fascinating. It may look a little busy here, but each of these colors represent a different variant of COVID. The wild type, which started, in Wuhan, China, quickly mutated to become something different. And we've had a number of different variants in Minnesota. If you look at that lime green variant in the middle there, that is the alpha variant. Remember last spring, alpha really hit our high school kids hard, a lot of our sports teams hard. Well, that you'll see that orange up at the top there, that big orange, that's Delta. And then Delta came in and just outcompeted. And then if you see that more red-orange or orange-red color right there at the very end, that's Omicron. Omicron is very distinct lineage from Delta, but you can see how it's now outcompeted and taken over. Next slide. Delta took about 8 weeks to become the dominant strain in Minnesota. It created a lot of viral load within a person. It really took over and turned our cells into virus factories. It was about twice as infectious as Alpha. It created really high caseload in Minnesota among unvaccinated and some vaccinated breakthroughs. Our hospital capacity, because we had so many people with Delta infections, was really at a breaking point. Next slide. Well, then Omicron came around, and Omicron was about twice as infectious as Delta. So we're getting really, really transmissible here. And it took over in about 4 weeks, only half the time. And you've probably heard that Omicron was less severe than Delta, which was really good news for us. That means it was it put fewer people in the hospital per case. The problem is we had so many people infected that our hospitalizations still went up. And again, hospitals were at a really critical, really critical place. And we also know a new thing about Omicron. It has immunoevasion, higher incidence of vaccine breakthrough cases. So people that were fully vaccinated and boosted, like myself, got sick with COVID. Well, and I want to got infected with COVID. One thing that vaccines did is they still protected people from severe disease. And I'll show some slides later on about that. A significant thing it did, though, one of the tricks in our arsenal is monoclonal therapy. This is used before someone goes to the hospital. So an at-risk person or person with higher risk of severe disease gets infected with COVID, we can provide monoclonal therapy. Omicron could have cared less about the main monoclonal therapies we did. They were no longer effective. And only one, citrovimab, was still effective against Omicron, but we have really not very many doses of that. We get them from the federal government, and it's been very limited supply. So that is a concern. One of the tools in our toolbox, Omicron, really set us back on. Next slide. This gives you an idea of how our cases have gone over time. That first big bump there, that was the Thanksgiving surge of 2000. That Thanksgiving surge that we had, 2020. Boy, I'm really losing. It's been Groundhog Day a little too long for me. And then you'll see there was another little bump in the spring. That was our alpha wave. Then we had that blessed summer last summer where cases really dropped down, and then Delta hit us. And Delta just was like a freight train going up and up and up. And then you can see how Omicron hit with a vengeance and just really swept through the state. Good news is it appears that we have peaked and are coming back down the Omicron surge. Wastewater data also statewide seems to indicate that is happening, although a few regions in the state are still on the increase. But the majority of the state has peaked. It's coming down. It's important to remember, though, when you are halfway through the forest, you're at the peak, you still have halfway to go. So we still have very, very high case counts in Minnesota, even though we are on the other side, hopefully, of the peak. Next slide. When we have more cases, we have more hospitalizations. We'll see what happened in that fall of 2020 when we had that Thanksgiving surge. we had a higher rate of residents who got sick going into the hospital than we did with Delta or Omicron. There's one real reason for that, and that is the vaccine. The vaccine protected people. Even if people got infected, they were protected from going to the hospital. However, the sheer number of people that were infected and the sheer number of people that were not protected by vaccine, we still were at a critical capacity with our hospitals. Next slide, please. Here you can see again, this is hospital census for our ICU beds and our non-ICU beds or our acute care. Hospitals, just like all things, are built to handle sort of their regular full capacity. Regular full capacity is you think of all the people that have a knee replacement, a stroke, they're in a snowmobile accident, flu cases, whatever. At the worst, that's what the system is managed for. And, you know, in a bad flu season, we might be 96, 98% of our beds full. Now, with COVID, you've added another 1,800 people that go to the hospital. Our system's just not built to handle that many new cases. And while we have done a lot in Minnesota to help support hospital capacity, you know, we've added beds, we've added space, we've even increased our staffing. It's really hard to train new docs and train new nurses and turn them out quickly. The other thing is that nurses and doctors, folks in the medical profession, are really burning out because COVID has been such an incredible demand on them. And we have people leaving the profession or dialing back their hours, making hospital capacity even tighter. One of the main things that we are doing from a public health perspective is how do we preserve and protect hospital capacity? Because at some point, we're all going to need to go to the hospital, whether I fall on the ice and hit my head, or I have a heart attack, or I get really sick with the flu, or my kid is sick. I want there to be hospital capacity. So we want to keep down the number of cases and make sure that those cases are less severe. Next slide. The other thing that we have been doing is really supporting hospital capacity. We are using a $40 million ARPA funding to help actually fund nurses in our hospitals. We're allowing for some regulatory relief of hospitals and nursing homes to add more beds if they need to quickly. We actually got 4 active military medical units from the federal government. Most of these were from the U.S. Air Force to work in our hospitals. That included doctors and nurses, active military. We have opened up what we call decompression sites. One thing that happens is you have folks in the hospital who have to be discharged. They don't necessarily need to stay in the hospital, but they still need care, the kind of care that a nursing home could provide. We've added these decompression sites to add capacity to take a less severely ill patient from the hospital and allow them to receive the appropriate level of care in a nursing home, freeing up a hospital bed. We've also given money to our nursing homes and long-term care to help them hire and retain employees. And we've actually deployed Governor Walz has deployed the National Guard to serve in nursing homes to provide support as skilled nursing response teams. Next slide. So COVID vaccines are obviously very important, and it is the main tool that we're using to protect our hospital capacities and to protect Minnesotans. We have 3 vaccines that are being dispensed in Minnesota, the Moderna vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, and the J&J vaccine. We just learned that Moderna received its full FDA license for folks 18 and older, and Pfizer is fully licensed for folks 18 and over. They're authorized under an EUA or emergency use authorization for 5 years and older. And they have just requested FDA to give it an EUA for 6 months, 5 years. And we hope to have vaccines ready for our youngest children to protect them around March. Next slide. We have vaccinated a lot of people in Minnesota in a very short amount of time. And this has been an all hands on deck effort. Tribal health, local public health, our pharmacies, state run clinics, such as we have at the Mall of America, doctors, nurses, first responders have been providing shots for folks throughout Minnesota to protect Minnesotans. And overall, our total population, so that's from 0 to 107, just under 70% of our population is vaccinated. For all those who are eligible, that is 5+, it's closer to 74%. And you can see that we have over 2 million people who have also received that additional dose or the boost or a third dose. Next slide. Boosters are really important right now. And if you are fully vaccinated, the CDC is now saying, let's make sure that you're up to date from your vaccines. So 5 months after your, sorry about that, 5 months after your second shot or your last shot, you should get a booster. And you can see here what a booster does with, especially with Omicron. So Omicron was tricky. It was able to get some evasion of our vaccines. But once you're boosted, that really increases your response and protection against infection. Next slide, please. But you can see with Omicron, we still had a lot of people who were vaccinated who got infected. I am one of them. My wife and I both got Omicron. She works in our schools, and she probably picked it up at work. I don't know for sure. But anyway, we both got infected. The good news is, though, next slide, we weren't really that sick because our vaccines protected us from being really severely ill. I felt kind of lousy one day. Now, my wife's a lot tougher than I am. She did quite fine, but I get man flu bad. So I had one day of being kind of sick. You know, I slept that day. But none of us went to the hospital, and that's what we're finding, is most people that are vaccinated, they may get infected with Omicron, but they still don't go to the hospital. Next slide. And even fewer people who are fully vaccinated die. Most of our deaths, sadly, are still in vaccinated folks. And this includes young Minnesotans. Even though most of our fatalities are our senior citizens, every day when I read the death reports, I see people who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, who have died, and almost all of them are unvaccinated. And many of them don't have any other pre-existing conditions. And
Mr. Huff, sorry to interrupt, but I think you stated it backwards. So could you just restate what you said? Because I think this is extremely, extremely important.
Sure.
That most of the deaths are in unvaccinated folks.
Right.
Is that what you intended? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for correcting me there. Yes. Most of our deaths are in the unvaccinated. Very few folks who are vaccinated. We do have some folks who are fully vaccinated that have died, but often those are really old folks who are already have weakened immune systems or folks that may have other severely compromised systems. The majority of people who are vaccinated may get infected, but don't die. The majority of our deaths are in the unvaccinated. And this is why vaccines are so important. And so those young people that I was mentioning, most of them are unvaccinated that have died, almost all of them. And it's really sad when I read those in the morning. We're talking parents who leave children behind. I think that's one of the reasons that we are so passionate about vaccination, because we really see what happens every day when we look through the death reports. So thank you for correcting me there, Madam Chair. I want to make sure that I say that correctly. Next slide. So that's my overview today. I'm happy to entertain questions, but I turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Huff. And we do have a batch of questions here. So let's see if we can get through some and then before we go on to Dr. Osterholm. So Representative Munson is first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for Mr. Huff. First of all, thank you for your presentation and making yourself available today for questions on this committee. You know, we try not to debate the science of COVID on this committee, but we do try to have a healthy debate on our reaction to COVID and what the government's response should be. This week, Johns Hopkins released a big study which shows that they don't have, they found no evidence that lockdowns and school closures and border closures, limiting gatherings and such had any noticeable effect on COVID-19 mortality. So my question to you is, how has this report and other reputable scientific studies showing the same results, how has it changed the advice that you're offering from the Minnesota Department of Health to the governor and the administration and to the legislature on its recommendations for responding to COVID and for future pandemics for public policy?
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative Munton, thank you for the question. I have not seen that report, but I'll definitely take a look at it after we're done here today. So I can't comment specifically on that report. What I can say is that we continue to look at the research. We continue to see what was effective, what is not effective. We have, I will say that if we look at Minnesota, compared to many of our neighbors, we'll see a lower hospitalization rate, and we'll see, most importantly, a lower death rate. And I think that really speaks for itself, that within the crucible of our surrounding of our neighbors, Minnesota has done amazingly well in our response in the entirety. But I look forward to taking a look at that report, and I know that Dr. Ostrom is on the call, and he reads a lot more of the literature than I do, so maybe he's more familiar. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, Representative Gernhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Huff, for your testimony and information that you gave us. You know, individuals who've come to me, they've got a couple areas of concern when it comes to the vaccine. Number one is the VAERS report, you know, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. On January 21, there were over 1,071,000 reported adverse events, including over 22,000 deaths, 121,000 hospitalizations, 40,000 permanent disabilities from the vaccine, and 29,000 of myocarditis, along with almost 4,000 miscarriages. What do you think of that information? And it is something that I think people look at and have concerns about. And then the lack of emphasis on natural immunity, which there's over 100 studies, according to the information I've been given or found, that show that natural immunity is better than the vaccine.
So, Representative Gernhagen, we're going to hear a little bit more about that natural immunity piece later in the presentation. But if we could, let's just stop here. It's a good question that you're asking, because I know a lot of people have had the same question about that reporting system. And I'd like to, rather than, you know, run into one question after another here, let's, if it's okay with you, let's put a pin in this that other one, because we're going to hear more about that. And I think maybe Dr. Osterholm will be well positioned to answer some of those questions, and let Mr. Huff deal with the first question that you asked, because I think it is something a lot of people will want to know about. And he can probably he's probably well positioned to answer that question. Is that okay?
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gernhagen, thanks for that question. So VAERS, as you mentioned, now this is a public reporting system where anyone in the United States can report that they have had an adverse reaction of any kind after a vaccine. It's also used by physicians and medical professionals to enter in. And this is one of the reasons that vaccines are probably the safest consumer product that you can purchase or have in America. And it's because every single potential adverse reaction is logged and then analyzed. So all of these reactions, the ones you mentioned, the myocarditis, mortality, or all the different ones that you mentioned, they're analyzed to see, Is that in line with what normally happens? So, or is it somehow there's like a signal there that it is higher than what the normal population, incidence you would expect in the normal population, and that it occurred only in people, there's no other reason except for the vaccine. So one of the things that I think is important is, let's say we had a system that we logged, you know, if you had been to the Mall of America and you got in a car crash or you had a heart attack or you got sick, did that have to relate to the Mall of America? Probably not. So we know that people get sick. We know that people get myocarditis. We know that, unfortunately, people die. What we have to see, is there a link between the vaccine or is it just something that would have happened anyway? And that's where the CDC and others really analyzed the data, and they have found a few instances where the an incidence or a you know, a side effect was higher than what we would expect with the given population. So pericarditis is an example in, say, young men. Then they look at, well, what's the risk of that pericarditis in those young men? It seemed, you know, it's very unpleasant. Pericarditis is not fun, and it can, you know, damage heart tissue. But we found that it did not have really severe impact. But then we look at COVID, and it's like, wow, COVID attacks that ACE2 receptors, which can attack the cardiac tissue, can actually be quite dangerous and can leave really long-lasting harm. It's comparable to, say, like airbags or seatbelts. The United States Transportation, Department of Transportation, when airbags were first deployed, tracked airbag injuries. And we know that airbags did injure people. But what we found is that airbags saved so many lives. Now, vaccines, we find, are actually a lot safer than airbags, and have saved even more lives. So it's, there's two things with the VAERS system. The first is it related to the vaccine, or is it just, you know, random in the population that things happen to people? And then if it is related to the vaccine, why? And then is there higher risk from the vaccine or higher risk from the disease itself that we're trying to protect? And what we have found is there are actually very low incidence of poor outcomes with the vaccine. And mostly it's because of, you know, the immune system response. It's not because there's some weird chemical within the vaccine. It's actually just a little bit of genetic material to simulate the response of the immune system. But I really appreciate you bringing that up. And that's one of the things that has become, I think, is a real herald and a hallmark of United States vaccine program, is its transparency, its real commitment to following up on all incidences that people report, and then really using robust scientific analysis to determine if it was linked to the vaccine, why it was, and then does that mean we need to change how we indicate the vaccine?
Thank you, Mr. Huff. And I guess I'd like to just see if I can state this in a different way, and you tell me if I get it right, okay? So the VAERS system is a reporting system where whoever wants to puts in a report. So this is not data that you can use for scientific evaluation of anything, because there's no, it's just a collection of reports. So anybody who thinks that they, you know, if I think that, you know, my house burned down, this is a silly example, but if I think my house burned down because of something that, you know, a medicine I took or a vaccine I took, I could report that into the VAERS. Does that mean there's any connection? No. But it is there for scientists to look to see if there are multiple reports that bear further investigation. But to say that there are X number of reports in the VAERS system just without knowing anymore, it isn't meaningful. I realize it scares people. But if you go to the VAERS system, which I've done and anybody can do it, it will tell you, there's a disclaimer there that tells you about how you should interpret what you see, because this is not a scientific, any kind of research enterprise. that you're looking at. It's just a collection of raw data that is self-reported by people. And so it's just people, I think, become overly worried by that because it, by its very transparency, it's available to us, but that then people misinterpret it. And I think, Mr. Huff, just tell me if I said anything wrong. And if I didn't, I think what I'll do is, you know, maybe Dr. Osterholm would, you know, if he has any further explanation or our other testifier, Dr. Vinesh Kachorn, has anything further on that, you know, because I think it is. I'm so glad that we're discussing it because it is something that comes up that people in the public do want to know about. So am I more or less correct in what I said, Mr. Huff?
Yes, Madam Chair. Anyone can enter whatever they want into theirs. And then it's the analysis to see if there's any correlations and any signals in the data that would say, oh, that's something that is not just random.
Right. Okay. Representative Gruenhagen?
Yeah, quick comment. You know, the other thing people are concerned about is they look at the bears and they see these adverse events and then they wonder why, you know, you said vaccines are the safest, in particular this one, and then we exclude vaccine companies from liability. So it seems like, contradiction. On the one hand, they're so safe. On the other hand, we exclude those companies and yet we don't do it to other companies from liability for adverse events. And the combination of which raises a lot of concerns with some of the people that I represent. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. That's a kind of goes off on a different issue. And I don't know if we're going to really be able to discuss that today. It's a federal issue also. But I think it, and I don't know if any of our presenters will want to comment on that. But I think yeah, I've heard that too. It worries people that there's no liability. But anyway, this is probably not the right day to discuss that. So let's see, Representative Pryor, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate this meeting and the ability to kind of follow up our own curiosity about COVID and where we stand on things. One thing I just wanted to maybe hear a little bit more data about. So I know a two-year-old that got COVID and got the Omicron, and he got a PCR test right before he started to have symptoms, and he had a PCR test as the symptoms began to clear. And it just, in my mind, a kind of a curiosity, are the PCR tests, the reliability of them, are they effective for all age groups, including the list ones of us that still can't get vaccinated, but we still want to know what's going on with them?
Mr. Huff?
So they were negative. The tests were negative in both cases, but the rest of the family had COVID, and he also was sick. So, you know, they're thinking that was before symptoms, it didn't show up. After symptoms, it didn't show up. Is it just harder to find, get accurate tests in age groups when they're so young?
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, thank you for that question. I'll have to look at the, I haven't looked at the data to see how it impacts, say, kids that young. However, no test is 100%. And you do have false negatives. The PCR tests are between 96 and 99%, we call it sensitive. That means if it's there, they're going to pick it up. So there's a lot of things that can impact whether someone tests positive. They could be sick, but just have a low level of virus circulating. It's just not enough to be picked up. It could be the sample wasn't great. If it was saliva, sometimes saliva is hard for kids to spit into the tube. There are all sorts of things that can impact a test. So I can't say specifically what happened with that child. Mm-hmm. But we do know that there is no test that's 100%, but we know PCR are around, 96 to 99% sensitive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Just a quick comment first on the whole issue of VAERS. I mean, I appreciated your example, Madam Chair, about the house burning down. I know you said that it was kind of a crazy example, but if you look at some of the things that are in VAERS, it's actually not that far off base. I've seen, I saw a chart, I was able to find it. I saw a chart once that listed several examples of things found in VAERS. And I, you know, I did find it online, but it included the VAERS ID. And I actually went into VAERS and cross-checked these myself. And they are, in fact, things that are listed as examples of supposed adverse reactions to vaccines in VAERS. And it included drowning, frostbite, hair color of beard changed, hiccups, sunburn, patient got tattoo after vaccination against medical advice. I mean, some of them are a little more off color than that, so I won't mention those ones in this committee. But I did check those. They are actually in VAERS, so I don't know that it can be relied upon as an example of adverse instances. The question I wanted to ask was related to the issue of boosters, and if this is a better question for Dr. Osterholm when he testifies, I'd be glad to hear about it there as well. Mr. Huff mentioned just that Omicron, the effects of Omicron can be alleviated, particularly if there is a booster. So I guess I'm just curious. You know, I had my booster, but it's already been a few months. I'm curious what efforts there are to expand boosters, and you know what stage those efforts are at in the FDA and CDC. So like, I'm wondering, you know, will I at some point when I'm eligible, I'm assuming it might be 6 months after the date of my booster, will there be an opportunity for second booster? You know, I have two kids that are 12 and 9 and have both had the appropriate vaccination for their age group as well. And I'm wondering if there are opportunities for the 12-year-old who had the, you know, adult dosage, you know, will she be able to get a booster at 6 months after her second dose? Will the 9-year-old be able to get, you know, a booster of the kid's dose at 6 months after his second dose? I'm just curious what, you know, given the level of protectiveness identified for boosters against Omicron specifically, I'm wondering what efforts there are to expand that.
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, thank you for the question. So the CDC has their guidelines, and what I'll do is I'll find them and put them in the chat for you of when to get your booster. Depending on, you know, one's condition, you might get a third dose or you might get a booster. So if you're actively undergoing cancer treatment, you would actually get a third dose. But if you're not, if you're fairly healthy, then you would get a booster. It's the same shot, but they're just called different because they're indicated for different medical conditions. But the CDC recommends 5 months after your second dose or your full vaccination that you get your booster. And actually, we have the first folks who, you know, the first thing that was recommended were for folks to get that third dose who are immunocompromised or, say, undergoing chemotherapy. That was 5 months ago that the first folks got their shot, and the CDC is saying, yep, go ahead and get your next shot then, your next booster for that. So it's looking like we'll be recommended to have it at 5 month increments right now. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. O on that one because I know he'll have more expertise on it than I do. And then Pfizer has, or rather the FDA has authorized the booster for our pediatric folks as well, our kids.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Huff. And we have gone a little bit beyond with this first presentation and really appreciate your answering these questions for us, Mr. Huff. And if you can hang around, it'd be great. I don't know if at the end if there'll be more, but I want to move on to Dr. Osterholm. And thank you so much for joining us today. And as you can see, we have a lot of things we really would like to ask about. So welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for having me again a year later. I look forward to the fact not being here next year at this time and hope that we all can agree that that would be an acceptable outcome. So thank you very, very much. Before we start, maybe, because I want to cover the issue of immunity, I think it is important to address the issue that we just had about VAERS, and I appreciate very much Representative Freiberg's comments about that. What people don't understand is life happens. And what I mean by that is, as you tried to point out, Madam Chair, what happens? Well, let me just give you some ideas of what we're up against. First of all, we're attempting to vaccinate millions and millions of people, particularly the older population, where outcomes happen every day, regardless of whether there was a vaccination or there was a visit by somebody. And most people don't realize, if you look today for fatal heart attacks in this country, for those who are 45 to 54 years of age, you can expect 46 a week in this country to die from a fatal heart attack. If you're 55 to 64, you can expect 79 a week. And if you're 65 to 74, you can expect 162 a week. Now, if we're vaccinating millions of people in those age groups, you're going to expect to see hundreds of events like that happen every week that would just be by chance alone, that they're going to happen no matter what. If you look at strokes right now, we would see 74 strokes in a given week in the population 55 to 64. That's just would be expected. We would see 139 strokes in the population age 65 to 74. Again, high target populations for vaccination. So I think I could go through a laundry list of these kinds of conditions that occur. And the myocarditis is a good example of one. Actually, if you look at the actual incidence of myocarditis in individuals who are teenagers who have received the vaccine, it just is barely above borderline for the second dose. Clearly well below that which happens if you get COVID itself. And it's a very different disease outcome. It's a much more severe illness among those who get COVID. If you get a third dose, actually, it's the same as baseline. We saw no difference whatsoever in myocarditis. So I think this is an important point to emphasize, that we have to look at these events as, are they out of expected numbers? And what happens is we keep just repeating what happens. We just keep saying there's so many deaths. There are so many people who reported this. The last piece I want to note is there actually is a very important and well-established compensation system for vaccines. Injuries. The National Vaccine Compensation Program, which is a federally run program, is a no-fault program that anybody who thinks they've been harmed by a vaccine can actually go to that program for any compensation, if in fact they think that's the case. We use those data all the time to help us understand, is this a vaccine that may have some negative impact? So I just wanted to share that it's not as if you can't find relief if you believe that you've actually been injured by a vaccine. So that's a very well-established program. But that's not why you have me here today. I'm here to talk about the issue of immunity. And with that, if I'd like to share my slides, if I can. Let's see here. Got them here somewhere. I had them. Sorry. Let me go back here and get out of this one and open it up again. I had them up for a second ago. Okay, here we go. Let me share that. Thank you for your patience. So today I've been asked to speak to the issue of immunity. Immunity both from the standpoint of the issue of from vaccines or from, in fact, having had infection. I will start out by saying right up front, number one, human immunology, the immune system response in infectious diseases like SARS-CoV-2 is not rocket science. It's more complicated than that. And I want to be clear about that right now. The second thing is that I will tell you what I know and don't know. And I think, frankly, there are days that I'm convinced I know less today than I did 6 months ago. But I'll be very willing to share with you why that would be the case and what we know about it. Hope you all you can see these slides here.
And but we can. And Dr. Osterholm, we're seeing the one slide and then the next slide. I don't know
if that's the presentation. Let me figure out how to get it.
If you want to do that.
No. Actually, I want to get that screen where I get to the full slide. Let's see.
Settings up at top.
Yeah, thank you. Display settings up here. Show task. Is this it?
Right next to that one. There you go.
Okay. How's that?
Yes, got it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. So anyway, you've already seen this slide. This is the virus that causes SARS-CoV-2 infection, i.e. COVID. And what the point is that there's all these little different pieces to the virus. And when we have an immune response to it, we're making a response to many of these different pieces. It's not just like it's one big plastic bag that goes around the virus. And these locations are changing constantly. And because of that, that is why protection against this can be somewhat daunting, just like it is annually with influenza. And today I'll cover that with you. First of all, let me just say there is no definition in public health. If you go look at any dictionary of epidemiology, there is no such thing as a natural infection. That has become a term of art that people use to infer if I've been infected with the virus versus not. Well, immunity is immunity. Infections, you know, et cetera. So there is no such thing as natural immunity. If people want to call it that, so be it. But what happens is you see in this upper left-hand side, let's just say you're impacted by a pathogen, which would be a virus. The first immediate response is what we call down here the innate immune cell response. This is actually the nonspecific response that certain things like white blood cells and so forth immediately attack something that shouldn't be there. But it's not highly specific. It doesn't have any memory of that specific thing is a bad thing. It just knows it's not me. Well, the adaptive immune response, which you see up here, is where we get into the memory, where we get into very specific targeted challenges. And what you see there are very complicated issues of part of it's all about T cells, cellular cells. Part of it's about B cells that excrete that antibody that that Dan Hoff talked about. And the fact of it is that both of these play key roles. And when people talk about developing antibody, for example, against SARS-CoV-2, there's actually three different kinds of antibody that we can measure. And we're not even sure what some of these measurements mean. We know that T cells play an important role, and yet they're very hard to measure. And so the bottom line message here is that this is much, much more complicated than as simple as a one test. Is it a one answer? No, that's not what we have. If you look at what happens when you inject, in this case, a vaccine into someone, you have this very complicated process that goes on where T cells process this, certain other cells do. T cells can help out with the B cells to make antibody, or they can, in fact, actually have memory that allow them to quickly proliferate. When we have a vaccine or a natural infection, it really depends on where these cells are at and how they respond. For example, we now have data that disease severity can be very important in how vigorous your immune response is. Some people who have very mild illness may only have very limited immunity develop relative to that. And it can wane over time. It can actually change. Representative Freiberg asked very appropriately, am I going to need a booster? Or what's going to happen there? And that means for some infectious agents, immunity can be a lifetime. Measles is a good example. For other ones, we have a very hard time developing any immunity. SARS-CoV-2 appears to fit somewhere in the middle, and I'll come back to that in a moment. We have all the different kinds of vaccines, but the ones I'm going to talk about today are the ones that basically are in this RNA, mRNA vaccine right here in this center left, the types of vaccines there. And what we are working on is how do we get the vaccines that best stimulate both the B cells and the T cells? What does natural infection do? And so that when somebody talks about an immune response, it's not just simply as natural or vaccine. It's not just as simple as one vaccine response. For example, if you look on the far right side, you'll see vaccines, inactivated vaccines. These are the ones that the Chinese have developed and are using. And frankly, they appear to be in serious challenge right now with Omicron. They're not working well at all against that. Whereas we see the RNA-based vaccines are, and I'll mention that more of that in a moment. So if you look here, one of the things we have to understand is we all need a correlate of protection. If you and I drive on our highways in Minnesota, we got a pretty good idea what the speed limit is. The signs tell us, okay? We know when we're going too fast or when we're not. And what we do is in vaccines across the board, we have what we call correlates of protection. These are basically measures of somebody responding to a vaccine or natural infection that says, if you have this much antibody or you have this kind of T cell activity, you in fact have enough there to give you protection. Well, protection depends on the coordination of the B cells and T cell responses. I mentioned earlier when people talk about antibody, are you talking about total antibody, neutralizing antibody, binding antibody? How long does that antibody last? Is it a big peak of activity and 6 months later dropping off? Antibody test results provide only a partial picture of an individual's immune response and protection. And oftentimes this has come up over and over again as an answer for if I've previously been infected, or for that matter, if I had been vaccinated, just test my antibody and find out if I'm immune or not. Well, it's not that simple. It just doesn't happen like that. The level of antibody, memory B cells, and T cells response associated with protection against severe disease is unknown. I couldn't for the life of me tell you today what level of certain protection I have to have. Now, we're working on that. We're trying to learn that because it'll be important in assessing how our vaccines work in the future. At this time, there is no specific antibody test or antibody threshold that can clearly determine an individual's risk of infection or serious illness. So if you look at the immune protection after vaccination and or infection, how does the immune response against SARS-CoV vary between vaccination and previous infection? Well, at this point, it does appear to be quite different, and I'll show you that in a minute. And I'm here to tell you that both of these immune responses are important. You know, I think we have found ourselves, unfortunately, having debates about non-issues, what I call how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. It's not about is previous infection-related immunity important. It is. It's very important. At the same time, what does it do differently than, for example, a vaccine does? And how does that happen? So this should not be a debate about are we going to not include a previous infection. How quickly does immunity wane over time? The question that was just posed by Representative Freiberg is we're seeing, particularly with both vaccine and previous infection, waning immunity over time. So you may be protected at time one or time two. By the time you get to time six or seven, you have now lost that protection. That's a very important concern. How do the variants of concern impact protection provided by vaccination, previous infection, or both? A lot. It turns out right now, if you're infected with Alpha, you're infected with Delta, you're infected with Omicron, it may be very different what the level of protection is that you have against a vaccine that has been static throughout that time. And I'll show you data to support that. I'm going to show you the studies that exist right now that really provide the best data. Let me just be clear. It is a myth that there's 100 studies out there that show natural immunity. It's a myth. It keeps getting repeated. I've seen it show up even in op-ed pieces and well-known papers. It's just simply not true. And so we have scurried through all the medical literature we possibly can, contacted all of our friends who work in any of these areas, and it just doesn't exist. Here's what we do know. If we take a look right now at these two studies, and I'll show you a series of them that were conducted. This involved 9 U.S. states from January to September of 2021. You're looking at both Alpha and Delta. What you found were unvaccinated people from a previous infection were over 5 times more likely to have a positive COVID test compared to vaccinated people with no previous infection. So in this case, you can see that the vaccine was much more protective than a previous infection. Didn't mean there wasn't some protection from previous infection. Another study from May and June of 2021 in Kentucky looked at Alpha. Among people with previous infection, unvaccinated people were 2.3 times more likely to be reinfected compared to a fully vaccinated person. So again, showing the same kind of pattern that the vaccine was actually superior in protection. Now, looking at these 4 studies, if you look at the ones from May 30th to June 5th, both conducted at the same time in California and New York, both looking at Alpha, the variant, same phenomenon, 2.5-fold higher case numbers among unvaccinated people with previous diagnosis compared to unvaccinated people. Compared to vaccinated people with no previous diagnosis. Same thing was true, look at Alpha in New York. The people who were vaccinated had a significantly lower rate of cases than those who only had previous infection and then got reinfected. On the flip side, if you look at the Delta data from California and New York in November, there we actually saw that COVID cases were 3.5 lower among unvaccinated people with previous diagnosis compared to vaccinated people. So there it flipped. It actually, with the Delta, we had evidence that previous infection at the time actually provided more protection through the duration of this study. So the point that I want to make is if you look at these, you'll find that it goes both ways. Bottom line message is neither are adequate for what we need, because both of these have waning immunity that occurs over time. This is a study here. I'm sorry, you can't see the top, looking at the rate of infection here is a major effort, looking over time. And this blue line is the unvaccinated, no previous COVID diagnosis. You can see what happened to them. Of course, during the big Delta surge, it went up substantially. This is the actual rate of the illnesses occurring. If you look at the dotted blue dotted line, that was a vaccinated, no previous COVID diagnosis. Very low, but actually not statistically significantly different. But right down there was, in fact, unvaccinated previous COVID-19 diagnosis, the point I made earlier about Delta. So in that case, having had a previous infection would have been considered basically on the order of protection that we see with adequate vaccination. Now, the challenge we're running into now is with Omicron, and this is where the issue with the third dose comes in. Let me be clear. I absolutely dislike mightily the term booster. I don't think it should have ever been called a booster. This always should have been a three-dose vaccine. It should be a fourth-dose vaccine for those who are immune-compromised, moderately or severely. The three-dose vaccine against Omicron has been highly, highly supported. If you look at the bottom, this is data from the UK, early December. The new report from the Imperial College in London, 19 response team, estimates the risk of reinfection with Omicron variant is 6 or 5.4 times greater than that of the Delta variant. This implies the protection against reinfection by Omicron afforded by past infection may be as low as 19%. So what it showed is that even with the protection you got from Delta prior, with Omicron, it may only be about 19% protection. So again, previous natural infection with Delta has played a little role. These are data that just have come out in the last couple of days. UK, again, which has a database activity well above and beyond ours and have had at least two additional weeks of activity with Omicron. But there right now, one-tenth of all of England's cases are actually reinfections. People who have previously been infected were now getting reinfected again. So what I really want to leave you with is the immune response following vaccination and or infection is very complicated. It's not as simple as saying it's a natural infection or it's a natural immunity or a vaccine-related immunity. And it turns out we're looking right now, for example, the J&J vaccine, which many people felt was not as good as the mRNA vaccines. Well, it turns out that that vaccine may stimulate certain T cells. That means over time that vaccine gets better, doesn't go down dramatically like an mRNA vaccine or natural infection, as some would call that. And so we're learning about how best to get the kind of activity that will be long in duration and broad in protection. And so anybody that comes before you here today that tells you they know and understand immunity and SARS-CoV-2 and exactly what a natural infection means or whatever, be careful because they probably have a bridge to sell you too. Clearly, both of the previous infection status and vaccine play a role in immunity and clinical outcome. I have stated for many, many months, I believe a previous episode documented of COVID infection should count as at least one dose. So I'm on record saying that, and I still believe that. And I think we need to move towards that. But at the same time, one dose is not going to be nearly enough. So vaccines are still going to be an important piece of this. Finally, as I started out my presentation, SARS-CoV-2 immunology in humans is really more complicated than rocket science. It really is. And we're learning a great deal about what the immune response means. We're learning about what its duration is. But remember, for these new variants, we've only had Omicron to deal with for the last 10 weeks. And this is what we've had to learn just in 10 weeks. I don't know what the next variant will be, but it could be also equally, if not more challenging, than we see with Omicron. And again, immunity is going to be a key piece. So I hope we can eliminate the debate about natural infection. I think this has been again, how many angels can dance in the head of a pin? It's about immunity. And it's whether it's from being infected or if it's from a vaccine, how long does it last? How wide a broad brush of protection does it provide, and what do I need to do about it? I would leave you with one last thing. I hope no one wants to achieve immunity through an infection, because that is by far the most challenging of ways to do it in terms of outcome. I have just had personally, I've been living and eating, sleeping this pandemic since December 30th of 2019. Only in the last week have I had four close contact individuals who have died from COVID in the last week. All of them, I've never had four in 1 week before. That's not the way to try to obtain your immunity. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to turn it back over to you and stop sharing.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Osterholm. I'm so sorry to hear about your folks that you've lost recently. And it is really, what a tragedy, terrible, terrible tragedy. So folks, we have a number of members with questions. We're also running quite a bit behind where we'd hope to be. And so what I would like to do, if it's okay, is call on Representative Grunhagen to ask the second part of his question, which I know was about this very topic. And then I've got Representative Hewitt, Representative Quam, and Representative Munson. And what I'd like to do is ask them to hold their questions, if they can, until we get our last presenter in. And our last presenter is going to talk about long COVID. So, and then I don't know, Dr. Osterholm, are you able to stay with us? And
actually, I can stay, unfortunately, till 4:30. I'm actually chairing another major call at that time that I have to start. So thank you.
All right. Well, let's see how much we can get in quickly here.
Thank you.
So, okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Osterholm, for your presentation. And I know it's not easy. And there's a lot of information swirling around out there. And of course, I, as a state representative, get a lot of feedback from my constituents about it. So it's one of the reasons I ask the questions I do, because I want to hear your or somebody else's perspective on it that might differ from some of the information that I've received. But just back to, I know you don't like the word natural immunity, but really two medical doctors have used it with me. And they think that it is better than the vaccine. They both told me. And the other thing is, do you like the idea of early treatment for COVID-19? Doctors are losing their, are being terminated from their profession because they use hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, vitamin D, and a few other things. And they're getting recovery with their patients, according to the, I've been invited to a couple presentations, and yet they're losing their job as a profession because they won't go along with the CDC guidelines, which they say they had lost patients under those guidelines. Yeah. Dr. Jeff Meyer being one of them.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen, just because of the time here, you got two questions in there. I'm going to ask Dr. Osterholm to respond briefly if he can.
Well, first of all, let me be really clear again that the data I just shared with you gives an example of where both a previous infection and vaccinations can play a role in immunity. But neither of them are perfect, hardly perfect. And the fact of the matter is we're seeing so many breakthrough infections right now of people who were previously infected who have not been vaccinated. And so I think that's by itself tells you that this is a challenge. We need to look at what else do you need. So it's not just you are vaccinated or you're an infected person or not. It's what else you're getting for vaccine. And I think that's important. The third, there's another point that, again, Representative Freiberg came back to you. The data we have on third doses against Omicron is compelling. Right now, the data released as recently as this week shows over 95% protection against serious illness, life-threatening illness against Omicron with a third dose. So I would argue that that is very, very important to get and that's what we ought to have. And, you know, I will, out of respect, Representative, say that, you know, it's not that I don't respect somebody who has an MD behind their name, but, you know, I have to go with the body of science. And just because an MD tells me something doesn't mean that that's what I will take away. I want to see the data. You know, the four-letter word I live by in my life is data. You know, I need it. Okay, so that to me is what's really important. And in this case, the data don't support their point. The same thing is true in the treatment. I'll just say, again, I go with whatever the treatment is. I'm agnostic. I want the data. The data for ivermectin, the data for vitamin B, the data for hydroxychloroquine show no benefit. And to actually put a patient on these drugs risks the issue of actually toxicity. Now, we see people all the time say, well, we've treated these people and they all got better, okay? But we need our the kind of trials where people are basically given the drug or not given the drug, but nobody knows if you got it or not. Double-blind placebo-controlled trials. And in those trials, over and over again, we've seen no benefit. On the other hand, we do see great benefit from the monoclonal antibodies and from the several drugs that the FDA have approved. And let me make one other last point. This has been universal around the world. The European FDA, the EMA, the Asian regulatory authorities, Singapore, Japan, all of these are on the same page. There's no difference between any country in the world. So it's not just the CDC or the United States. This has been a universally accepted scientific finding, and I just share that with you. So I would hope that none of my loved ones would be ever treated with ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, if they were to have COVID.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Osterholm. We really appreciate it. And, you know, I can see that we probably should have a lot more hearings just on. I think one of our presenters, we probably could have spent the whole hearing with questions and discussions. So,
and Madam Chair.
Yeah,
and
Representative Gernhagen, because we need to move on. Yeah.
You know, the people that I talk to, the medical professors, they say they're using the science. So that's part of the problem. They're both saying they use the science, and I'm a lay person trying to figure out the difference. Thank you.
All right. Okay. So I know we have some other members on the list, but, you know, out of respect to our third presenter, I'm going to ask them to hold their questions, and hopefully we can have some time at the end for more discussion. So Dr. Vinesh Kashorn, thank you. I hope I'm saying your name properly. Welcome. Thank you very much for your patience. And please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Yeah, no problem here. And good job with my name there. It took me about 4 years of my life to get that right. So that's pretty good straight off the bat there. Let me just bring up the PowerPoint here. I think you should all be seeing that by now.
Yes.
Well, again, I really appreciate the opportunity and I feel very grateful here to be speaking with you. I am an occupational and aerospace medicine physician at the Mayo Clinic. And today I'd like to share with you just briefly some information about a new condition that is affecting many people across our state and across our country. And that condition is called long-haul COVID. So let's just start with some basics here. What is long-haul COVID? Well, the answer is it really depends on who you ask. This condition is so new. Right now, we don't even have an agreed-upon name for it. Some people call it long-haul COVID. We call it post-COVID syndrome. The NIH calls it post-acute sequelae of SARS-CoV-2, which is quite a mouthful. In addition to that, we also don't have a universal definition that we agree upon. We have made some progress in this area. For example, the World Health Organization did release their formal definition in October of 2021. And you can see the requirements there. The most notable requirement being that patients must have symptoms that last longer than 3 months from their infection start. Now, however, the CDC has a different definition. First of all, they call it post-COVID conditions. And they apply that term to pretty much anything that is ongoing 4 weeks or more after the infection start. So right now, while we have definitions for this condition, they are hardly defining. While that remains nebulous, what we do have a good understanding of at this point is the symptoms that people experience as part of this condition. Now, the information in this slide, as well as the slides that follow, comes from a study that we did here at Mayo Clinic, looking at the first 100 patients that presented for treatment of long-haul COVID here. In this slide here, you can see the most common symptoms with fatigue and respiratory conditions leading the pack. The fatigue in this condition is quite profound, with patients saying they have difficulties with things such as putting on their clothes or doing simple household chores. In addition to the fatigue and respiratory complaints, we also hear a lot about neurological symptoms such as headache, troubles with thinking, commonly known as brain fog, sleep issues, as well as mental health complaints such as anxiety and depression. Now, when most people discuss long haul COVID, they tend to focus in on the symptoms like we just started. But unfortunately, the symptoms are really only half of the challenge with this condition. The other half is how those symptoms affect a person's ability to live their lives. And unfortunately, that effect is bad. At the time of presentation to our clinic, about 34% of our patients had troubles with some of the most basic activities of life, like putting on their clothes or using the bathroom. 82% reported difficulties with the more routine things of life, such as driving a car, cooking a meal, or going grocery shopping, and of course, difficulties with going to work. Now, 63% of our patients at the time of presentation had been able to return back to work in some form, and that seems promising on the surface, but it's important to know that the average time between infection and presentation at our clinic was 3 months. So another way to look at this is that at 3 months out from an infection start, only a little bit more than half of the patients had been able to get back to work. In addition, of those patients back to work, only about half of those were back to their normal duties. So this is a condition that has significant functional implications. Now let's turn to risk. Who gets this condition? Initially, we thought that the patients who had the most risk of having a severe acute infection would be the same ones who get long-haul COVID. Well, it turns out that this actually isn't true. We haven't seen this in the research. In fact, 75% of the patients that we have seen here at Mayo Clinic in our program did not have any form of severe acute illness. They didn't need to go to the hospital. They didn't even need to see their primary care provider. They had very mild infections. We also have not found any relationship to pre-existing health status, such as asthma or high blood pressure, no relationship to pre-existing mental health conditions or relationship to chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia. In addition, patients in our clinic, they tend to be younger than those patients that we associate with more severe acute cases. And interestingly, more of our patients are female than male, and this has been a finding that has been repeated in other studies across the world. The takeaway point from all this is that long-haul COVID really is a condition that anyone can seemingly get at this point. And what about frequency? This is a question I often get. How frequently can we expect long-haul COVID to occur? Well, here in this diagram, you can see the frequency of long-haul COVID found in various studies around the world. And this comes from a research study that was trying to answer the frequency question and was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in November. And what you can gather from this seemingly random pattern of dots is we really don't have any idea at this point how often this is going to occur. Now, this study did find that prolonged symptoms were occurring in 54% of patients who had COVID-19. Now, I think this is likely an overestimate for various reasons that I can't get into right now. But nevertheless, what I can assure you of is that long-haul COVID is not a rare condition. Even the lowest findings in this diagram are still roughly in the 10% area, and 10% of millions of people is a lot of patients. As for prognosis, unfortunately, we are now almost 2 years into working with this condition, and we now have some information and research about how patients are doing over the long term. The most recent study was just published 2 weeks ago out of New York City, and it looked at 530 patients and how they were doing 12 months out from their infection. And what we found is that almost 45% of patients reported worse health and persistent symptoms. 40% of patients also reported functional difficulties, such as carrying groceries or walking around the block. So unfortunately, the name long-haul COVID does appear to be an appropriate name for this condition. All right, we discussed a little bit about what long-haul COVID looks like and its implications. Let's turn our attention now to how do patients get care for this condition. Patients come to our clinic via a few common routes. Some may be referred, but really not that many, unfortunately. The majority of our patients are self-referred. They hear about our program through the news or the internet, and they call for an appointment. In addition, we also have a small selection of patients that are referred to us directly from insurance companies like workers' compensation insurance. Now, if this seems like an oversimplification, it is. The path to treatment is actually quite difficult, and when it comes to getting care for long-haul COVID, the real only consistency we have seen is inconsistency and hardship. If there's one universal thing that we have seen amongst all patients who present for care seeking care for long-haul COVID, it's that they feel abandoned. And it's easy to see how this may happen. Unfortunately, long-haul COVID, again, is a very new condition, and not many providers know about it, not many patients know about it, or the public. And so because of that, patients with these symptoms, they're often told some very unhelpful things, like what they're feeling is simply impossible, that they are just experiencing anxiety or depression. The worst answer is you just need to tough it out. Because of this, patients often begin to turn in on themselves. They begin to question, what is wrong with me that is making me have this prolonged recovery? What did I do to be like this? Because of that, patients often have guilt, self-doubt, clinical depression, anxiety, and PTSD sometimes even. I want to highlight this because this barrier to care and this pattern that forms in patients is one of the major challenges ahead with long-haul COVID. Now, when it comes to actual care itself, there have been a handful of treatment centers that have opened here in Minnesota, including our very own at the Mayo Clinic. We actually have two programs here available for patients. The COVID Activity Rehabilitation Program is the first program, and I'm also the medical director for that program. We focus on helping patients 0 to 3 months out from their infection, and we have seen patients from all across the United States for long-haul COVID. In addition, there's also the Post-COVID Care Clinic, which strives to help individuals who are more than 3 months out from their infection. In addition to Mayo Clinic, there have been a few other health systems that have developed programs, which you can see listed here. And in addition to the medical care, there is also an abundance of clinical research that is occurring, primarily at academic medical centers. Most of the research right now remains focused on just seeing and understanding how this condition presents across different patient groups. Hopefully, as we move forward into 2022, we'll have more research looking at clinical trials and treatment options and trying to understand what is going on at a chemical level in patients. Now, while this all has been a good start, it is important to note that right now, most of the care and research for long-haul COVID remains siloed in the major medical centers and in the major cities. In addition, there is not much collaboration going on between the different programs. But fortunately, the Minnesota Department of Health is attempting to fix this problem. Recently, as a first step in creating a statewide strategy for long-haul COVID, the MDH launched their own long-haul COVID website. And it's the first repository we have now for resources for patients and providers. And hopefully, this is just a first step with further collaboration resources. Hopefully, we can develop a further statewide strategy, including guidance documents for patients and providers, even employers, thus improving the opportunities for care, even out in the rural areas. That being said, we have several challenges ahead when it comes to long-haul COVID. One of the ones that I am most particularly concerned about is that we have not seen a good representation of all socioeconomic and ethnic groups in our long-haul COVID clinics. In particular, laborers and entry-level workers appear to be missing, and I worry that they are suffering in silence and facing barriers to care that we have not appreciated. In addition, right now, there is no way to know how long-haul COVID is affecting the state. We have no centralized repository or registry for patients who are suffering this condition. In addition, we also don't have enough providers available to take care of this. Our schedules are quite packed with patients seeking long-haul COVID care. And finally, there is a potential impact on the workforce. As I mentioned earlier, patients with long-haul COVID, often they have difficulties getting back to work in a timely fashion. And I fear that with the Omicron surge, There is a pending tsunami of absent workers ahead of us in the months to come. And just to kind of give you some reference of the looming problem, I'll leave you with these calculations. As of this week, there have been 74.3 million COVID-19 cases here in the United States alone. If we conservatively estimate that 10% of those individuals will come down with long-haul COVID, that gives us 7.4 million long-haul COVID cases in the U.S. Based on our research, we expect that 30% of those patients will have difficulties getting back to their work in a timely fashion, if ever. That leaves us with 2.2 million people unable to return to work because of long-haul COVID. And these are not just nameless numbers, but these are bus drivers, laborers, physicians, nurses, you name it. So the challenge ahead of us with long-haul COVID is not just a healthcare challenge, but a challenge for our society and our economy as well. And with that, I'll finish up and leave my contact information there. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Vinesh Kachoran. That is very, very interesting. We do have some members with their hands up, and I guess, but I just have a quick one. I didn't see anything in there about, if you know, we've talked about different kinds of immunity from vaccination, immunity from acquiring infection. Have you seen in your data any difference with patients, whether they were vaccinated or not vaccinated, in terms of long-haul COVID?
It's a great question. I only have anecdotal evidence at this point. I will say that we have seen patients who have been fully vaccinated and boosted, who then come down with COVID and then had a prolonged recovery. And I'm happy to report that those individuals, they seem to be recovering better and faster than the patients we saw early in the pandemic before the vaccine. Now, this is science, so I'm not sure if it is because the patients are being vaccinated beforehand or the fact that right now we are seeing patients a lot sooner than we were early in the pandemic. People know about long-haul COVID, so they're seeking treatment now 4 weeks out from their infection versus 3 to 4 months. It is something that we are researching actively, and I hope to have some more information here in the near future.
Great. Okay. So I know that the other members had their hands up before, and so I think what we could do is go to Representative Quam and then Hewitt, because we are kind of out of time here, and I don't know if we may have to ask members to submit questions, and I think we can perhaps get some follow-up, but Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the one I had for Osterholm was a year ago, I had asked them if they had looked at, you get Pfizer, then you got the Moderna, or if you looked at J&J as a booster. And I think it'd be good if we could get that type of data from them, because there have been cases. But specifically for this last presentation, my understanding is that the data is taken from several thousand studies. And my understanding is that many of those studies, or the predominant number of the people in the studies, were hospitalized. We believe early on a vast quantity of people were asymptomatic, so that if you're only looking at the people who are hospitalized, and that's a subset of the people that received, contracted, then your percentages would be factored lower. And then the anecdotal information about the pre-vaccine post, we also, with the vaccine, have gained many therapeutics, and that those therapeutics may be decreasing the likelihood of the long term. And maybe if we could touch on what maybe is trending, and then you've got the variants popping in there, and we all know different variants affect stronger or weaker to the lungs, et cetera.
Dr. Vinesh Kachoran, can you tackle that? I'm not completely clear what the question is, but maybe you caught it.
I think so. A couple of comments I'll make there. Thank you again for that question and that information. I totally agree. Yes, the research into the frequency of this it has looked at very specific patient groups, patients coming out of the ICU, patients not in the ICU, and so forth. And that's why right now, based on the research that occurred, it's really hard to come up with those estimates. And patient populations like that may have led to the estimates being higher. But in addition, there's also some information, or also some studies out there that have gone out and simply surveyed individuals who have had COVID-19 to see what they're experiencing. And those kinds of surveys of large patient populations sometimes can lead to things being overestimated as well, too. So it's kind of hard to tell right now where we are exactly with the numbers, which is why I mentioned that earlier. But I can definitely say that we are not running out of patients to see with this condition. Our waiting list right now for treatment, as well as many other centers, is out for several months. As for the insight into improvements and whether or not it's related to the vaccine or not, again, just anecdotal evidence. I don't have the scientific controlled studies, the well-designed randomized controls trials that we need in order to actually make a full-on assessment of the relationship between long-haul COVID and the vaccine.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Hewitt.
I'll go as quick as I can. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Doctor, there's a couple of us, Representative Wolgamont, are working on presumptions here of professions that we see clearly probably contacted this in their work. I didn't see any slides that indicated that. Have you seen a spike in nursing, or have you seen a spike in grocery workers? Where, real quickly, where have you seen that that spike? And then if you could kind of relate to what your prediction would be on what this is really going to cost us in the long haul. I mean, this could be like a, these people could end up like an asthma patient forever. Am I correct or am I wrong? So I'll be quiet now.
Dr. Venetia Kishorn.
Sorry about that. Thank you very much for that question. The cost of all of this is something that I have been very much worried about. And right now I don't have enough information to give any kind of dollar amount. What I can say, though, is that we have patients now who are still requiring care more than 2 years out after they started visiting with us. So, yes, there is this high possibility that patients with this condition could be entering into a chronic state. As for who gets this condition, occupation-wise, well, of course, individuals in the healthcare system are often exposed to COVID-19 and come down with infections. And so we have seen a large amount of healthcare workers. But we also see all sorts of other professions right now, except for laborers and entry-level positions.
Okay. So I think we're going to have to stop there. I'm sorry, Representative Munson has his hand up, but we are out of time. And we so appreciate your presentation today, Dr. Venetia Kishorn, and the other presenters, too. I know Dr. Osterholm dropped off. Members, if you have other questions for any of the presenters, if you want to submit them to the committee, we will gather them and see if we can get responses for you. I think, you know, that would be a good organized way to do this. And just, again, really appreciate the good questions from members and wish we had more time, but I'm sure this is not the last time we're going to be discussing this issue. Unfortunately. So thank you, everyone. And with that, we stand adjourned.